This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
I did the dumbest thing possible, and I sat down and had a few drinks and thought, all right, I'm going to look online, see what I could find. And when I read the police report, I bawled. I'm like, how is this person my dad? How does someone that I came from do something so heinous and unforgivable? It was like I'm reading a horror movie.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. I am your host, Alexis Linkletter, and Jack Vanek has been called out to emergency surgery. So I will be filling in for a portion of her part today, and Billy will be filling in for the other.
Yes, we are thinking about Jack. She had an emergency surgery. She is okay.
An emergency appendectomy. She's A-okay.
Yes.
But it happened literally the day we were supposed to record. So you know what? We're going to be team players and we're going to just step right up. Billy and I are used to this. We're not sick of each other yet. I think we can do this, Billy. What do you think?
Yes. And we're going to jump right in to the day.
Oh, we are. You don't want to have any banter with me?
No, this is the banter right now. This is the banter that we're doing. This is where we're going. This is going to go. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Today's December 8th, 2021. National Brownie Day.
I like a brownie. Brownies, honestly, I say sometimes that chocolate's not worth it unless it's a brownie. That's my favorite dessert.
Interesting.
But I don't like nice ones. I like the box kind.
Okay. All right.
Because I like the batter, frankly. I'm not here for the brownie. I'm there for the batter.
It's also National Christmas Tree Day. I guess they're trying to say, like, this is when you should put your Christmas tree up.
Mm.
Not too early. Not too
late. Not too late.
You don't want it to be, yeah.
Yeah, but like, I want a full month of a Christmas tree.
Yes, but December 8th is also the day that John Lennon was murdered. And that was probably like one of the biggest like true crime moments of my life, because I remember going downstairs and my mother telling me, don't be mean to your dad today. He's very upset.
Well, that is upsetting. That was a horrible, horrible tragedy.
Yeah.
Any other days?
It's also National Lard Day. So
okay, so what do we think of that one?
I mean, we got lard and we've got brownie day, and I think they potentially could be, I think there's something related to those two.
No,
a brownie like recipe a good brownie calls for lard.
It calls for vegetable oil. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I like a coconut oil. It gives a nice little flavor.
Yeah.
No lard. Not here.
Yes, but those are all the days.
All right. Well, I guess that's enough of that. So let's turn down the lights. And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you. Oh, we miss you, Jack.
I hope we did you proud, Jack. People from all walks of life become victims of violent crime. And similarly, so do those who commit unspeakable acts. Killers are mothers, fathers, sisters, and brothers. Daughters. Killers who have families who end up paying for their crimes. There's trauma. There's shame. There's guilt and confusion. All prices family members of killers are forced to pay. Well, today, we're going to speak to someone who knows about that burden all too well. We begin today's case on March 11th, 1991. To set the time, badass women artists like Mariah Carey, Celine Dion, and Whitney Houston ruled the top 10 music charts. Silence of the Lambs had been out for almost a month, and it was still the number one movie in theaters. George H.W. Bush announced that the Iraq War was over, and plane loads of U.S. troops arrived home. An outrage was setting in on a national scale as a video of LAPD officers beating Rodney King came to light.
The setting for today's case is Phoenix, Arizona. That's a place I know very well. Incorporated in 1881, Phoenix is home to 22 sovereign Native American tribes. It's got 1.75 million residents, which makes it the fifth largest city in the U.S. And you know what? I'm a goth and I live there. I don't like it, but it's the sunniest city in America. 85% of all daylight hours have sun.
And while the setting for the crime we're covering today is Phoenix, Arizona is not where our first degree Nikki was born and raised. But don't worry, the geographical implication of this story will come into focus soon enough. All you need to know for now is that Nikki reached out to share a story she's been grappling with for a very long time. When Nikki was in her late 20s, she was having a conversation with her mother, who revealed to her some shocking news. The father, who Nikki was estranged from, was in jail. He'd done something bad, really bad, and Nikki wanted to know more.
When my mom finally let it slip, I'm like, well, you're not leaving it at that. And then she finally told me that he murdered someone and he was on death row.
Whoa. So Nikki's father murdered someone, was in prison, and on top of that was actually on death row. Her response to this news, of course, was complex. You see, Nikki hadn't heard from her dad since she was 10 years old. Her memories of him were conflicting. There were great times, but there were also times of terror. She knew he wasn't the best guy in the world, but she never imagined in a million years that he could be a murderer. I'm sure you have a lot of questions, just like Nikki did. What did her dad do to land himself on death row? We're going to tell you. And in order to do that, you know the drill. We got to go back to the beginning.
Nikki was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Her parents had been married a few years prior to her arrival. And 5 years later, her brother Danny was born. Nikki's mom was like her best friend, strong, loving, and protective. Nikki's father's name was David Gulbranson. And she had fond memories of him too. She recalls a funny, charismatic guy who commanded every room he walked into.
I remember when I was very young, this was before my brother was born, we were at their friend's house. They were, I think, probably playing cards and drinking. And we were outside in the front yard playing, and a bunch of older teenage boys, because I was, you know, maybe 5, 6 at the time. And these older kids made some comments to me and my friends. And, you know, we're little girls. And I don't know if it was me or someone else ran inside and, you know, tattled. And my dad came out and basically kicked their ass and went to jail that night because they were underage.
On the outside, David may have seemed like a good father. And sometimes, as Nikki describes, he was. But that was far from the totality of David's character, and even farther from the reality of the situation. Nikki's mom did an excellent job shielding her children from the truth about their father, because she didn't want them to know that, aside from struggling with bipolar disorder, their dad was a raging alcoholic. And when David had too many drinks, he turned into a nightmare. Now, at first, he seemed to only fight people he thought were being mean to his loved ones. But the more David drank, the less he cared about who received the brunt of his rage.
His drinking got so far out of control that it got to where he was mean, not only to people that were hurting me or my mom, or he was just crazy, a little bit crazy.
David's drinking continued to worsen, and he was getting scarier by the day. He came home drunk almost nightly. And Nikki told us about one of those nights and describes how the scenario between her, her mom, and her dad unfolded.
I remember him coming home one night when they got in an argument and he was throwing dresser drawers around in their bedroom. And I came in to see what was going on, which was probably stupid, but, I was a little kid. And my little brother was just born. He was a baby in the next room. And I remember him picking up a loaded shotgun and pointing it at us. And, of course, my mom stood in front of me because she wasn't going to let me be hurt. But for whatever reason, he never pulled the trigger. Thank God.
Nikki's mom did her best to disguise her fear in front of her children, which was part of how she protected them. Even when she was standing in front of that loaded gun, she didn't want Nikki to know how scared she was or that they were in any real life or death situation. But one night after experiencing the chaos of her father's drunken rage, things got so bad that Nikki's mom couldn't mask her fear any longer and refused to remain under the same roof as this man.
I do remember she must have been afraid one night because we left after he passed out. Me, her, and my brother, we packed up and snuck out in the middle of the night and went to her friend's house. And I remember sleeping in one of the beds, just afraid that he was going to show up.
Sneaking out in the middle of the night was Nikki's mom's first step in divorcing David. But she still felt like the children needed their dad in their lives. So she let David have visitation. And looking back, Nikki thinks her mom regrets allowing the visits. But at the time, she thought it was just going to be best for everyone. Eventually, the visits tapered off, which frankly can be seen as a blessing. And then eventually, David stopped calling and picking up his kids altogether. However, he would still call and harass his ex-wife whenever the mood struck him.
Nikki's mom, now free from David, moved on with her life. She eventually met the kind of man she truly deserved, and that relationship became more and more serious. This new man proposed, and they decided to get married.
I do remember him, after my mom remarried, him calling, drunk, of course, and screaming that, this man's not going to raise my kids, and how dare you?
Nikki was around 10 years old when this call happened, and she only talked to her dad a few more times after that before he disappeared completely and even the calls tapered off. David went off and lived his own life, and while Nikki didn't have communication with him, she did remain in touch with her grandmother and aunts on her father's side.
I was still in touch with my grandma, his mom, and my aunts with his sisters, and they didn't really talk about him much because, he was a terrible person. And I mean, my aunt was a school teacher in a Lutheran school, and my other aunt was a nurse. I mean, these were good people, and I think they tried to just avoid the talk of anything that had to do with my dad, because I mean, obviously they were disappointed in him too, being family. And God bless my grandma, God rest her soul. I mean, that was her one and only son, and he was a huge disappointment, and he had so much potential. He was a very intelligent person and a very, like I said, charismatic. And I mean, when he wasn't drinking, he was a good person, but that drinking became to be every day and to excess.
Nikki eventually lost track of her dad. She built her own life. She grew up, she got married, she had children, she had two of them. But as her marriage progressed, to her shock and horror, she slowly began observing a recognizable pattern within her own family.
It's the cliche of you marry a man like your dad. And I did. I mean, my ex-husband was a big drinker. He was very abusive, and he was just an all-around bad person. And I stuck with it because we had two kids together, and then it got to the point where, you know, there was a few times I was afraid of him, and it's like, wow, you would have thought that I would have learned from watching my mom, but I guess the cliche is kind of true. I don't know if you seek out someone that's like your dad, or you just think that that's all you deserve, because I mean, even his family said, what are you doing with him? Get rid of him. And I just kept sticking it out. I'm like, he'll get better. Things will get better.
Okay, so this is something I've learned in therapy myself. So as adults, we subconsciously seek what was normal to us as children, even if that quote-unquote normal was being in an abusive rapport with one of our parents. For whatever reason, it's a dynamic we're programmed to recreate, and it's something we're comfortable with. Beyond that, and most importantly, it's very common.
You know, after it started being more physical abusive, I took my kids and I packed us up, and we had backpacks on our back, and I moved up north to where I had family, and I left him. And it was like, I did what I needed to do to get away from the same cycle of abuse and alcoholism, and I moved up north, and me and the kids, you know, we struggled for a while, but, you know, we started to flourish, and I was their parent, and then I eventually ran into my current husband, who I had gone to school with years ago, and I ran into him, and he was getting out of a relationship, and I had just gotten divorced, and we reconnected, and we've been together for 12 years now, and he's helped raise my children, and he's the complete polar opposite of what I was married to for 10 years.
And here's a message from Nikki that she really wants to drive home.
You can get out of that cycle. It's just so many women fall down that same path. It's like you see what your mom goes through, and you see what a horrible relationship she has, and then you turn around and you're in the same exact position. It's like, wow, how stupid can you be?
Just like her mom, Nikki escaped this toxic relationship and found the man of her dreams. With that being said, if you're in an abusive relationship, please reach out for help. And that's obviously, it's always going to be easier said than done. But Nikki and her mom are great examples of how the cycle can be broken. You can learn how to feel comfortable in a more healthy setting.
So Nikki was successfully rebuilding her life, and her dad was not on the forefront of her mind at all. But that all changed in her late 20s when Nikki learned that her father was sitting on death row for murder. Nikki wanted to know more. I'm sorry, she actually needed to know more.
I did the dumbest thing possible, and I sat down and had a few drinks and thought, all right, I'm going to look online, see what I could find. And when I read the police report, I bawled. I'm like, how is this person my dad? How does someone that I came from do something so heinous and unforgivable? It was like I'm reading a horror movie.
So before we get into the specifics of the crime, we have to tell you where life took David Gulbrandson in the years following the abandonment of his family. So David eventually bounced around from girlfriend to girlfriend, and he eventually settled in Phoenix. But this ping-pong from one woman to another stopped in 1990 when he met a woman named Irene Cattaran. Irene was originally from Pennsylvania. She was a 43-year-old mother and a freelance photographer. She had three children, Melissa, Jennifer, and Michael. David was actually also working as a freelance photographer at the time, so he and Irene had a lot in common. The couple fell in love, and eventually David moved into Irene's house, which she'd been living in for 2 years with her daughter and son. In fact, the relationship went so well that they eventually started a photography business called Memory Makers, which they ran out of Irene's house. The relationship went well, at least for a while. But then David's drinking habit began to rear its ugly head once again. His drinking worsened to the point that it was hurting the business.
So things between David and Irene were falling apart. So much so that by January of 91, Irene actually asked David to move out of her house. So it turns out Irene had been unhappy for a while and had rekindled a connection between her and her ex, this guy named Evan, who she dated right before David came into her life. So needless to say, things were not good between Irene and David. And then there was this pesky circumstance of having to continue to work together despite breaking up and the tension between them. And they're working out of her home. So Irene can't escape the stress of this, you know? I really empathize. Because at this point, David was starting to become very paranoid that Irene was actually cutting David out of the business completely and perhaps stealing it out from under him. The truth was, of course, Irene did want to run the business on her own. She was miserable. Who wants to work with a hateful, resentful ex as you're trying to start a new relationship? But Irene had no intention of screwing David over. What she wanted to do was buy David out fair and square. The dissolving of the relationship and the contention over the photography business started to take a real toll on both of them. So according to David's mother, he was apparently so stressed out about this that he stopped eating and he stopped sleeping. He lost weight and he spent a lot of time pacing the floor. David's mom allegedly was so worried for her son that she traveled from Wisconsin to Arizona to intervene and to try to get him some help. But he wasn't interested. His refusal meant that things would continue to worsen between he and Irene, and they did.
While Irene was working her hardest to move on, she couldn't sever ties with David, and she had to continue to work with him. And then on Valentine's Day 1991, things really came to a head between the two exes. They were in the presence of two friends who were named Sally and Charles. It's unclear where this exchange actually took place. Wherever they were, David ended up getting very drunk. And as we've learned, when David drinks, he becomes extremely volatile. David started arguing with Irene. Then out of nowhere, his hands were around her throat, and he was strangling her. Luckily, there were two other people with them. Their friend Charles was able to grab David and pull him off of Irene before she was seriously hurt.
And it was later revealed that when Charles and Sally drove him home, David said, quote, "I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill the business. I'm going to kill everything." So Irene did not take this attack from David on her lightly. She absolutely feared for her life. And she immediately filed for and was granted a restraining order. And when David was served with the paperwork on February 27th, he was furious. And according to the person who served David the documents, David freaked out and called Irene all sorts of names, which included a bitch. He was also ordered to attend an alcohol rehab program in Wisconsin. And he was supposed to go to Wisconsin to do this on March 11th.
Now, rest assured that there was a protective order in effect. So Irene goes on a business trip to New Mexico with her new boyfriend, Evan, the weekend of March 8th, which is about 3 weeks after David attacked her. The purpose of this trip was for Irene to sell some of her photographs. On March 10th, around 7 p.m., Irene made it back to her Phoenix home with some cash and checks from her sales. Upon her return, one of Irene's daughters told her that David had called twice while she was gone. Both times, he had been angry that she was selling his photos. Now, it's unclear whether these photos were actually David's or if he was just paranoid that Irene was cutting him out of the business. We don't know. But later that same evening, David called three more times. Each time, David threatened to kill her and kill her boyfriend. And each time, Irene said she didn't want to talk to him and told him not to call back. And per the restraining order, David actually wasn't supposed to contact Irene at all. The calls eventually did stop. And as the night got quiet, Irene and her daughters retired for the night. When Irene's 14-year-old daughter woke up the next morning, all appeared normal. When she wandered to her mother's room to wake her up, she found that she couldn't get inside the bedroom because the door was locked, which was really unusual. She kept knocking, but there was no response. Then she spotted a dark stain on the wall leading into her mother's bedroom, and it looked like blood. At At that moment, she sensed that something was really, really wrong. So she called her grandmother, who then called the police. When officers arrived, they learned that Irene's car was missing. When they did an initial canvas of the interior of the home, they found something extremely alarming. In the kitchen sink, they found four bloodstained knives and a pair of scissors with what appeared to be hair jammed in them.
The officers then made their way to Irene's room. And what they saw inside was right out of a horror movie. When I was growing up, I took French in high school, but I could never get the language to stick. I wanted to be fluent so bad, but it never happened. I just couldn't focus and I couldn't practice enough and it didn't work. But thankfully, there's Rosetta Stone, which is the most trusted language learning program, and it's available on desktop or it can be used as an app on your phone or tablet. Rosetta Stone is different. It immerses you in so many ways. And with its intuitive process, you can pick up any language naturally, first with words, then phrases, and then sentences. And before you know it, boom, conversations. Plus, with Rosetta Stone's true accent feature, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronouncing words. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the First Degree listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/first. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/first today. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for all of your springtime goals. If you don't have time, Factor's ready-to-eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. So you just get to eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up. You really just heat and savor the good stuff without all of the stress. You can customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Plus, you can pause and reschedule your deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution to premium, fast meals without the need for cooking. And they're celebrating Earth Day all month long. So look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. I'm so busy, so it's amazing to just have Factor meals in the fridge for whenever I realize that I'm starving and I don't have any time to cook anything. They're amazing, they're healthy, and they keep you fueled all day long. Head to factormeals.com/degree50 and use code degree50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's degree50 at factormeals.com/degree50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Hey, there's no reason to feel sad or guilty about the things you aren't using anymore. Whether it was a fancy dress you wore to a gala, expensive heels that only go with one of your outfits, or that crossbody bag from when you were in your music festival era. Somebody out there wants what you don't, and the real world makes it easy to get it to them. When your past becomes their future, everyone wins, especially the planet. For the real world, Earth Month isn't just another month. It's what they do every day. At any given moment, they're finding new homes for over 1 million unique items within their community of 35 plus million people. They're the largest luxury reseller in the world and making a tangible difference towards a more sustainable future for fashion. Resale reduces the amount of fashion waste in landfills, lowers greenhouse gas emissions, and offers an alternative to the cycle of consumption propagated by fast fashion. The RealReal has kept over 37 million items in circulation and out of landfills. This month only, new shoppers get 20% off when they shop on therealreal.com using code FIRST. That's therealreal.com using the code FIRST. Over the weekend of March 8, 1991, 45-year-old Irene Cattaran had just returned home from a business trip that she'd gone on with her new boyfriend. When she got home, her ex-boyfriend and current business partner called multiple times. This is David, of course, her ex, despite having a restraining order against him. And Irene demanded that he stop calling her. The following morning, Irene's 14-year-old daughter went to wake her mother up and found a dark stain on the wall leading to her mom's bedroom. The police were called and were about to enter Irene's locked bedroom. They made their way inside and discovered a truly horrifying scene. The bedroom was covered in blood, and clumps of Irene's hair were strewn about. Some of the hair had been cut, some was burned, and some had been forcefully ripped out by the root. There were drag marks on the ground, and when officers followed them, they were led to the bathroom where they found Irene. She was face down and wearing only a pair of underwear with her legs bent up behind her. Irene's ankles were tied together by an electrical cord attached to a curling iron. Her right wrist was bound with an electrical cord attached to a hairdryer. Irene had been brutally murdered, but the true extent of the torture Irene endured wasn't known until the autopsy was completed. In addition to many blunt force injuries, she'd been stabbed at least 34 times, and the most serious stab wound punctured her liver, which on its own would have been a fatal injury. The wounds were inflicted with multiple knives, scissors, and a wooden salad fork. And one of the prongs was still found in Irene's leg. I mean, this was a brutal, savage attack on her. And it's, the mind boggles at it. Her nose is broken. She had broken ribs. Her thyroid cartilage in the front of her neck was fractured. Like, it's truly hard to even read all of this. So I'm going to stop. The injuries were beyond overkill, beyond catastrophic. So, yeah. Her official cause of death was from multiple stab wounds and the blunt neck injury, which may have resulted in asphyxiation. And horrifically, the pathologist determined that most, if not all, the injuries were inflicted before death. So Nikki, our first degree, you know, she sat down one day and decided to research this. She's in the midst of learning what her father had done, and she's horrified.
I'm like, what is going on? I mean, this can't possibly be what happened, but it is. I mean, I looked at the court transcripts and it's like, oh my God, it was quite a blow. And it's like, what do you do with that information? You know, it's not like, hey kids, guess what? Guess what grandpa did?
The investigation began immediately, and as soon as law enforcement learned that Irene had recently taken out a restraining order on her ex-boyfriend David, that was obviously the best place to start. They went to his apartment. When they knocked, they got no response. They began surveillance in case he was potentially purposely avoiding them. When they didn't see anyone, they decided to conduct a welfare check. They supposedly wanted to make sure that David wasn't inside his apartment, maybe bleeding out from an injury he sustained during the struggle. They entered, looked around the apartment, noticed bloody papers and a bloodstained jacket, but there was no sign of David. But they couldn't really, you know, search the apartment because they didn't have a search warrant, because this was just a welfare check. So they started working on getting a search warrant that would let them legally search his apartment. Now, meanwhile, back at Irene's home, the police began searching for more and more evidence. As it turns out, David did not do a good job of cleaning up the crime scene before he left. In addition to the bloody knives and scissors that we found in the sink, officers found more physical evidence tying David to the murder. On a paper towel holder in the kitchen, officers found blood and David's fingerprints. On the kitchen counter, there was a Coke can with a bloody fingerprint belonging to David. And in Irene's bedroom, a banker's bag with blood on it was found. However, the cash and checks from Irene's sales that she made on that New Mexico business trip, selling the photography, they weren't inside.
And at around 8:20 p.m. that day, armed with a warrant, police legally searched David's apartment. They found checks from Irene's New Mexico trip, but no cash. There were some memory makers' business papers from the business Dave and Irene co-owned together. And those papers had Irene's blood all over them. Police also found black clothing that was covered in Irene's blood. It turns out David had dressed in all black when he went to Irene's, like some sort of wannabe predatory ninja. In the pocket of the bloody jacket they'd seen earlier, police found Irene's credit card. The investigation was in full swing when investigators were alerted to a strange phone call from David's mother, Dorothy. Now, David's mom, Dorothy, said that she just received a call from her son, David, and he'd made a chilling admission. He said that he'd done a terrible thing. He then admitted to killing Irene. He told his mother that he was going to kill himself, and she was worried that he was going to follow through with his threat. Now, when police asked where David was, Dorothy told them that she truly didn't know, and that he didn't tell her. And they believed her because she wanted them to save his life.
Sure. So the police needed to find David, but there was nowhere to know where he was. Remember, this is 1991. No cell phones to track or anything like that. So we had an old-fashioned manhunt. And the police asked for the public's help to locate the 46-year-old David. And they did this in news segments. They showed his picture. They gave a description of Irene's vehicle, which David had stolen after he killed her. Tips began rolling in, and the day after the murder, one of the tips said that they had seen David gambling in Laughlin, Nevada on March 12th. He had apparently lost more than $1,100, and they offered him a free hotel room as a comp. Now, it's unclear why, but this David sighting did not lead to his capture, and David remained on the move. Oh, and it was never officially proven, but it's assumed that the money he was gambling with was the money that Irene had made during the business trip.
The next time David was spotted, he was in Montana, and apparently he was trying to sell Irene's car to a bar owner. But when he couldn't produce the title, the bar owner changed his mind about buying it. It's unclear why David was in Montana, but the assumption was that perhaps he was trying to flee to Canada or just heading kind of back up north to Wisconsin, where he's from. Weeks passed, and on April 1st, a police officer in Montana discovered Irene's car abandoned with a flat tire near the city of Great Falls. The car had Canadian license plates, and an Arizona plate was found under the driver's seat. Then on April 3rd, the manhunt finally came to an end when David was finally tracked down and arrested in a Montana apartment complex after a neighbor called in a tip. Once he was in custody, he was promptly charged with first-degree murder and theft.
Over the next few years, David would change his story many times about what really happened the night of March 10th. Now, in the beginning, David said that he went to Irene's house to get his spare key because he locked himself out of his place. When he got to Irene's, David claimed that she was, quote, angry, hostile, and disrespectful. Then they started arguing about the business. David described it as a real screaming match. But then, conveniently, David has no memory of what happened after the argument, or how Irene ended up being killed in such an awful way. Now, later, David's story evolved when he revealed a different version of events. This time, he said when he got to Irene's, he knocked on the door, she opened it a crack, and told him to leave. He begged her to look for the key, and she eventually went to look for it. But she couldn't find the key, so she let David inside to search. Then a shouting match ensued. It escalated to the point where Irene threw scissors at David. Now, in this version, he still claimed not to remember anything that happened after that.
Right, and David would go on to change his story yet again. He told the same story about going inside Irene's house to search for the key, but in this new version, David said he was inside for hours before the murder actually occurred. In David's mind, since he was there for only hours before the murder occurred, it could not have been premeditated. It had to be a heat of the passion murder. I'd say this makes total sense, but he wore like a cat burglar suit to do it. But anyways, what we're seeing here, obviously, is that his defense was trying to get the death penalty taken off the table and trying to get these charges downgraded to second-degree murder. But the prosecution was not budging. This case was just too heinous. The charges of first-degree murder remained, and the state announced that they would, in fact, be seeking the death penalty in David's case. And we're driving this point home because, you know, Nikki discovered that her father was on death row, and that generally suggests, like, the most awful, egregious kinds of crimes. And it's, you know, traumatizing. So when David's attorneys strategized as to their defense strategy, they opted to try the next thing, an insanity defense. We've talked about these a lot on this podcast. They asked the court to approve a CAT scan for David due to a prior head injury he'd suffered. It seems as though they were trying to uncover a physical injury they could point to prove that David could not have and was not sane at the time he killed Irene. Unfortunately for them, David's CAT scan came back normal. Back to the drawing board for the defense. So then the defense introduced what's referred to as some mitigating factors. You know, we mentioned these in passing a lot, but they're generally things that incite some sympathy, basically reasons for why they turned out the way they did, like abuse or neglect or a mental defect, something like that.
Mostly things from the person's childhood.
Childhood or some traumatizing events of adulthood or a head injury, something like that. And one of these mitigating factors were these claims of alleged childhood abuse that David had suffered at the hands of his alcoholic father. So he claimed that his father would strike him, push his face into plates of food, drag him by his hair, and more. And these attacks allegedly happened at least once a week, starting at the age of 4 and ending at 12 when his parents finally divorced. So certainly these things that happened in our childhood, I think we all, no one's raised in a perfectly healthy environment. And we can all point to them as excuses for our behavior. But, you know, it's a choice to be abusive and not seek help, to not be reflective and understand that, like, maybe you need to do some work to not be violent. You know, I don't know.
No, there's so much stuff there, and it's so much nuance. But at the end of the day, as a lot of people are listening to this, they might have had rough childhoods. They might have had parents who had struck them and dragged them by the hair, but they didn't turn into somebody that killed somebody.
That's right. And some of the best, most empathetic, compassionate people I know had horrible childhoods. So I think there's no excuse for this kind of act. I think we can all agree with that.
Still trying to prove that David was insane at the time of the murder, the defense asked a doctor named Martin Blinder to examine David. Now, Dr. Blinder found that David did have a history of being abused by his father. His mother and siblings actually confirmed all of that. He also found that David had a history of depression and alcoholism, for which David had actually been hospitalized for multiple times between 67 and 84. Dr. Blinder diagnosed David with 4 separate things: dissociative episode and fugue state, bipolar disorder, alcoholism, and a personality disorder. He went on to theorize that David might go into this sort of dissociative episode or fugue state when he was in a stressful situation. For example, if he was in an argument and an object, let's say a pair of scissors, was thrown at him, he might just check out, disassociate, lose control, and act violently. But even with this, David was not insane at the moment he killed Irene. That meant David wasn't insane in the eyes of the law, which really threw a wrench in this whole defense. Ultimately, it was concluded that David's charges would stay at first-degree murder, with the death penalty still on the table.
David's trial began on November 30th, 1992. And the prosecution focused on convincing the jury that David planned to murder Irene, and he'd been planning to since at least Valentine's Day, because remember, he told his friend he was going to. And he did it because he was worried she was going to steal the business from out underneath him, and he was mad that she was dating someone else, an ex of hers. Using 2 psychiatric experts, the prosecution focused on proving that David was not insane when the murder was committed. Psychiatrists for the prosecution testified that David wasn't insane at the time, and his ability to remember an incident had nothing to do with being insane. They also couldn't prove that he didn't remember it. They also both concluded that David suffered from a clinical mood disorder of a lesser severity than manic depressive or bipolar disorder. He was far from legally insane. The defense, however, admitted David killed Irene, but stuck to this idea that he did not remember doing it. And David's attorneys focused their defense on this aspect of insanity. They were hoping to convince the jury that while David wasn't insane in the eyes of the law, he was insane enough to not know what he was doing. Basically, the defense said David went to Irene's to get his key, not to kill her. He was stressed over losing his business potentially, stressed over losing this relationship, and lost control after she threw scissors at him. Something I want to remind everyone is she had a protective order against him. He never should have been at that house.
No,
so like,
no.
you're not going to win, dude. You weren't even supposed to be there. She was legally afraid of you. You had tried to kill her before. He wasn't supposed to be there at all. And they claimed ultimately that he went into a dissociative episode, was not acting consciously when he murdered Irene. It's like textbook heat of passion is what they were going with.
So the jury starts to deliberate, and they're actually allowed to consider second-degree murder and manslaughter in addition to first-degree murder. But in the end, the jury agreed with the prosecution. David was guilty of premeditated first-degree murder. David obviously was not happy about this. And just like a true narcissist, he was shocked that the jury didn't believe his story.
During the sentencing phase, the judge looked at aggravating and mitigating factors in order to determine David's fate. Now, little aside here, a mitigating factor is something that a defense leans on to help garner sympathy and mercy, frankly, in the sentencing phase. That's the primary use of the term. An aggregating factor would be something horrible that happened during the crime, which goes against a mitigating factor, something like lying in wait. You know, a lot of them are attributed to like capital punishment, extreme cruelty, extreme neglect. Like they have a whole category of them depending on what state you're in. So the judge looked at all the things that made the case extremely awful and all the things that could have explained why David became this way. And that's what he's looking at to decide his sentence. And one of the aggravating factors was that the crime was committed in an especially heinous, cruel, or depraved manner. And mitigating factors, of course, the abuse David suffered as a child, he was claiming. And trying to butter the judge up, David told the judge that he'd gladly and willingly accept his fate and that he was devastatingly sorry. He said Irene didn't deserve to die and he hadn't planned or wished to kill her at all.
The judge sentenced David to death on February 19, 1993. After Irene's family and friends gave their impact statements, David's true colors came out. He said his trial was a, quote, mockery of the judicial system. He followed with, quote, "You get a family up here. They are grieving and everything else. They want some answers. There was no answers provided for them. Sure, they get up and say, well, let's kill him. Someone dear was taken from you. They said, revenge, let's kill him. Something is very wrong here. I'm disgusted. Shame on you and shame on this system, period. I'm through talking." Yeah, nobody wants to hear from you anyway, dude. David, forever the victim. So David goes off to prison and starts serving his sentence on death row. So while David had already long been on death row, when our first degree Nikki learned that her father had killed Irene. Nikki had a ton of processing to do with all this information. And the last thing she expected was to ever hear from her father again. After all, why would she? He vanished for her life when she was nearly 10 years old, but that's not what happened. Because approximately 25 years after Irene's murder, Nikki gets a letter from her father, completely out of the blue. She hadn't heard from him in 40 years.
So needless to say, this letter came as a huge shock. And when we come back from the break, we'll find out exactly what David had to say.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
David Gulbranson had been sitting on death row for 25 years when he decided to write to Nikki out of the blue. And she recalls the morning she picked up her mail and saw the letter from him.
When I saw Maricopa County, Arizona, I was like, well, there's only one person I know there. And it was a 6-page typed letter. And at first, I didn't even want to read it because I'm like, how could you possibly have this much to say? I haven't seen you in 30 some years.
So why exactly was David reaching out to Nikki now?
He talked about, how he was so happy when me and Danny, my brother, were born. And my mom was the love of his life.
Clearly, David is doing some revisionist history here when he wrote that Nikki's mom was the love of his life.
I'm like, really? Because you treated her like shit. She picked you up at girlfriends' houses and you crashed all the cars that we had and you were verbally and physically abusive. How was she the love of your life? It was all about him. It wasn't about, this is what I did and I'm sorry for this. It was a very disappointing letter, I guess. I would have expected after all those years for him to say, I'm sorry that I screwed up your life so bad. And I'm sorry I did this. And I'm sorry that I am on death row and I will never be able to see you or my brother or my grandchildren.
After reading the letter, Nikki was put off. She really wasn't happy about it. She didn't have any expectations for the letter, but it was still surprising to see how self-involved her father still was. It just seemed like one excuse after the next.
It pissed me off because I read it, and again, it was all about him. And he never said, I am so sorry for what I did and this and that. He just made it seem like he was the victim, that his alcoholism did this. And I never got the feeling that he was sorry for what he did. He was sorry that he got caught. That's how I took it.
There's still this looming question of why David was reaching out now. Nikki thinks the fact that he's on death row may offer the explanation.
I think he wants to make himself feel better. I don't think he really cares that about me personally or my brother. I think he, being such a narcissist, thinks maybe if I do this, I will feel better and I'll be able to go to my death with a clear conscience, but trying to make amends to my children. It's like, I don't know. It seems like he's trying to make himself feel better, not me.
As far as Nikki is concerned, David's efforts should be focused elsewhere.
It's like, don't make amends with me. Make amends with the family that you destroyed by killing their mother while they were sleeping in the next room. I mean, what kind of monster only cares about saving face with his children? Talk to the family that you killed their fucking mom. It just makes me think that maybe he's a sociopath and he only cares about what's important to him and not the right thing. I don't get it.
Nikki wasn't then and still isn't sure how to handle this letter. And she grapples with whether or how to respond.
I have written several versions of the letter and I have yet to send it. I don't know if I ever will. I don't know if he deserves it. I don't know if he deserves that closure that he is so desperately looking for, or if I just let him die a broken man and be just put it aside. I'm not sure how I want to do that. I don't want him to think I've been waiting all these years for him to reach out to me. I want him to know that I'm mad that my mother passed away and this piece of shit is still alive. I'm mad that my brother is a lot like him. Not violent, but my brother has had a lot of alcohol and drug issues. And that's on my father. I totally believe that because he was never part of his life.
What we have to consider here are the complex emotions one would be feeling if you were in Nikki's position. There are so many conflicting feelings, so many unanswered questions, and Nikki ebbs and flows in terms of how she feels about it. She's unsure about the letter, has considered visiting him to tell him how she feels, but then is unsure of that move as well. And you know what? Any choice Nikki makes is the right one. Because outside opinions, especially in a situation as serious as this, should never impact how someone chooses to grieve or process a lifetime of pain, trauma, confusion, and information like this, frankly. Like, unless you've literally had a mirror experience to Nikki's, you could not know how to feel or would not know the right way to handle it either.
And I don't even know if death row inmates can have visitors. I haven't even checked that far, but my husband has asked me straight up and said, do you want to go see him before he dies? And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe it would give me some kind of, I don't want to use closure because everyone uses that closure. Just a peace of mind in saying, you didn't fuck me up that bad. I got past all of this and I have a wonderful husband. I have three amazing children. I have grandchildren. You didn't stop that from happening, even though you're a horrible person and it could fuck up a lot of people, but it didn't. It could have. I went down the wrong path and married the wrong person, but overall, I was strong enough to get past it and get to where I was supposed to be in life. And maybe I want you to know that.
So David is still on death row. And in March of 2021, the Arizona Department of Corrections announced that they plan to start carrying out executions again. Arizona hasn't held an execution since 2014. Now, this was after an execution was really, really botched, when it took 15 injections instead of just one, and it was an agonizing 2 hours instead of 10 minutes for an inmate named Joseph Wood to die. Following this, Arizona put a hold on all executions while they reviewed their procedures. So while the executions in the state were on hold, the search for a more reliable lethal injection cocktail went underway. And apparently, they found one in March of 2021, which meant that approximately 20 inmates who had exhausted all of their appeals immediately became eligible for execution.
And one of those 20 people is Nikki's now 77-year-old father, David. And Nikki truly doesn't know if or when her father could be executed or how she'll feel when it happens. And it's this weird thing where she may want to respond to the letter, but he may, you know, these executions, and I'd be interested to understand the process. They kind of come up out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
When they do decide to do one, and I don't know if it's political pressure or whatnot, but it's a horrible pressure that Nikki doesn't deserve to have. No. As to whether or not she wants to respond to this letter, and maybe she's not ready and she shouldn't have to feel rushed because of this.
She didn't ask for any of this.
Exactly.
I don't know how I'm going to feel once it does. I mean, when it boils down to it, he is my dad. But I don't know if I'm going to feel relieved or if I'm going to feel sad. I guess I just want it to be final and just finally get it passed and move on.
Nikki's experience very well demonstrates the ripple effect of violent crime and acts as proof that with perseverance, you too can break cycles of abuse, despite how bad this abuse may be.
The actions of our parents, or I mean anyone in our family, it's not what should define you. And if it is something as terrible as your dad killed someone, talk to someone about it. Don't let it sit there and fester for 30, 40 years. You can't define yourself by anything anyone else has done. And I guess, takeaway is if there's something that is bothering you for this many years, talk to someone about it. Get it off your chest. It will make you feel better. And just like this conversation right now makes me feel better. Talk about it. Don't let it eat away at you.
We want to give the hugest thanks to Nikki for listening to the podcast, for reaching out, for your candidness, your vulnerability. Thank you for helping people understand, you know, what it's like for individuals like you who have people who connected to you in this way. I think it's a lesson in empathy for sure.
Yeah, it's one thing too, because we talk a lot about, you know, pushing people to enter their DNA into databases and things, but it's another thing to have your father having killed somebody and then reaching out to you, which you did not expect before. You're going along with your life and then this happened. So
yeah, Nikki, you're amazing. Thank you so much. For all of you listening, Jack is usually the outro person, so I'm going to do my best. Follow us on Instagram at The First Degree, at Alexis Linkletter, at Billy Jensen, at Jack Vanek. Buy some merch. Don't forget to listen to Killing Time, coming out every Thursday, the day after this on a Wednesday.
And just remember, only you can prevent serial killers and keep your friends close.
But not that close. Try Billy.
Happy Lard Day.
Happy Lard Day. Now you're stealing my lines. That's all mismatched. We miss you, Jack.
We miss you, Jack.
Shout out to Jared Monaco for scoring original music for The First Degree. Writing for today's episode is by Haley Gray. Additional producing for this episode by Caitlin Cleveland. Sources for this episode: ABC 15, Cronkite News, KJZZ, Death Penalty Info, The Guardian, Court Documents, and as always, our First Degree guest is always our largest source.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.